Call the Labor Congress Committee order. We have in attendance Representative Donnelly, Representative Bruckman, Representative Finkelstein. We're going to take the bills in the order of naturopathy first, common trust fund second, review of travel advisories third, autonomous trust fourth, disclosure of real property sales fifth. If we need to bog down any one of them, we'll put it off to the end so that we don't keep people here too long. Representative Newberg, if you could
Mr. Chairman, if
remind
I
us where we were on natural.
We had completed all the testimony. You just didn't have a quorum. And let me tell you the two things that need to be done. Number one would be to adopt the 3-9 CS. And number two would be on page 2, line 18 of the bill, strike association with and put the office of there. You'll recall that this was the naturopathy bill, and the only change that we did in this proposed CS was that they must be licensed at the time of application. And then the proposed amendment I'm suggesting on page 2, line 18, would make certain that in association with means that they are working temporarily in the office of the naturopath. I think you need a quorum to deal with that, and then you should be able to take those two. I can go to the other.
We are pretty far along that, I forgot. Let's.
Can we go to the other bill?
Yes, let's go to common trust fund.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that amends the Uniform Act and updates the Uniform Common Trust Fund Act. And the Common Trust Fund Act is in effect in around 26 states, and it's an old Uniform Act. It was enacted in around 1938, the purpose of the Common Trust Fund Act was, and it's been in effect in Alaska since 1964. It's a technical banking bill, and what it does is it allows banks to put several trust funds together for ease of management. Under the common law, you can't create a common trust fund. You have to manage each little trust fund separately. And like, let's say you have a family trust, you'd have to have a special trust fund for that, and the bank would have to manage it separately than somebody else's. And this allows them to pool it and, you know, manage this on a good basis. Well, since 1938, banks have started to affiliate with other banks. And affiliating is a technical term, and it's defined by the Internal Revenue Code, and it means basically 80% common ownership. And more than half of the states that have enacted the Common Trust Fund Act have provided for affiliations. And the common language that they use is the language of Section 2 of the bill, which provides that it references the relevant section of the Internal Revenue Code, Section 1504. And the folks at KeyBank would like to be able to manage in common with their affiliated banks, and this is putting really their suggestion. And I think it's a valid point. As I say, more than half of the states have done this, and that's all it does. Wes Coiner's here from the Banking Association, and I'm authorized to state, and Wes, let me know if this is incorrect, that they support this. And I'm not aware of
Wes is nodding that it disagrees with you. So. Just kidding. Wes nodding agreement for the record.
I see he's about to leap over to the table. So. That's, and I would just urge his favorable consideration. I'm non-comfortable.
Any questions from any committee members?
A brief one, and it's probably not relevant. I think I'm assuming these trust funds are the kinds of things that gain interest in their investments. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be real estate trust fund accounting, because that's usually just a savings. It's not.
Yeah. Well, and Wes, correct me if I'm wrong. As I understand it, a bank can act as a trustee. Frankly, I don't know whether they can be a trustee for trusts involving real estate. Customarily, they deal in personal property. securities. Can a bank trust department manage real estate?
I'm not sure either. The banks have to delay it because the personal loan.
We can get somebody on from KeyBank if you want. Okay.
Yes, through the chair and answer, I believe.
State your name.
Oh, certainly. Andy Drove, Director of Occupational Licensing. While not directly involved in this from the banking side, but as far as real estate, I believe Representative Rutland's question would have referred to trust accounts maintained by real estate brokers where they're taking the money and keeping it as a fiduciary until the transaction closes.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's new, generally not invested. That's a separate accounting.
Right, and it's not interest-bearing and so forth.
Right.
And they do like pull those, but just keep a separate record via deposit slips and transaction number. Banks, trustees, department, do manage real estate. Minor children that have inherited until they come of age and that sort of thing. On a fairly regular basis. And rent it out, collecting receipts and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I trust Representative Bloomberg's statute here.
That's a loose comment.
We have... We also have in attendance Representative Lackey and Representative Parnell. Are you there online? I think Representative Parnell is there.
And he has stepped out of the room momentarily.
Okay. Representative Lackey, you've got before us House Bill 469, which adds the word affiliates to these common trust funds.
Is there anyone want to do this?
And Max will tell
us
why you want to do this again.
Oh, sure. This was put in at the request of some of the banks, particularly KeyBank. It's updating a Uniform Act, the Uniform Common Trust Funds Act, which is a 1938 act that's been in this state since 1964. And since it was originally enacted, over half the states that have enacted it have expanded it to include affiliates, because some banks now have affiliates. And that's defined under the Internal Revenue Code to include an 80% common ownership. And so this simply updates, and KeyBank is the main bank in the state that would like to use it. The other members of the Banking Association are represented by Mr. Coroner here, and they support the bill.
I still don't understand why you want to do it.
It allows the banks to have a common trust fund with an affiliated bank, and it's for ease of management, and it's for efficiency in managing. It's much easier and better to manage several trust funds together rather than having to manage them separately. That's just what the modern banking practice is.
And these trust funds on behalf of individual depositors in the bank, or are they trust funds that the bank controls themselves?
They're trust funds on behalf of depositors and actually trustors who establish it through the bank. That's what we're talking about.
And how, can somebody give me an example of one of these situations?
Sure, a family trust is set up, and it's a relatively small trust of $500,000 or so, and then they pool that with a number of other family trusts and manage it jointly. And with the affiliated bank, they would do it with that bank as well.
So the pooling would involve money that different clients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly how it works. They keep separate with the accounting, but they manage them jointly in a common trust plan.
And then if the trust loses money or something happens to the trust, they all share equally in the penalty or the loss?
Of course. Yeah, that's the way always a trust works. If you're investing in the stock market and there's you have a drop in the stock market, then each one would share proportionally.
I think just to try to make it even more practical, it sounds to me like, if they're investing these in stock market or funds or something, one of the benefits of being able to proof them up more is less fees that go with it. The larger amounts you have, the lower your fees are. And that could be one of the reasons that important.
That's correct. Yeah, the fees go down considerably, the brokerage fees, when you have larger pools. Absolutely. And And the cost of management, the fixed cost.
We need to get through a bunch of these bills before Representative Donnelly has to leave, so if you still have questions on this, I'll put it on the bottom of the list, Representative Donnelly, or anyone else, another committee member. Have any questions still? There's no problem holding you over. We just have so many bills to get through before you leave.
Sure. I got to reset it. So whatever you want to do.
Anyone have any further concerns on this legislation?
No, I think I have.
Okay, is there a motion for action? Representative Brecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that the committee pass this out with individual vote.
Is there objection to passing the bill out with individual recommendations? Hearing none, so done. Let's go back to naturopathy. House Bill 437. We heard, had the hearing, we completed all the actions. We didn't have a quorum at the time. It's now back before us. What we need to do to proceed on the course we were on before is to adopt the CSB for us and put it in the words based on the discussion we had at the last meeting in the office of instead of association with. Does anyone have any questions or anything else before we start marking the bill up? Is there a motion to adopt the CS? Representative Brecker?
I would move to adopt the CS. I don't have it in front of me,
so do you have it? It's dated 3992. Is there objection to adopting the CS? The hearing now stopped. The amendment we discussed last time was on page 2, line 18, to take out the words association with and insert the office of. There's a feeling it was too vague to allow an aspirant to operate with his temporary license without someone licensed in the same office. An association with might mean in a series of offices. You weren't even in the same office. So we thought this would tighten up. Someone want to offer that amendment? Representative Brecker's offer the amendment. Does everyone understand the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Representative Donnelly?
Are we amending the CS?
Yeah, we adopted the CS.
Right, and then what's the amendment again?
Page 2, line 18, where it says association with. Stick in the office of.
Under the roof of? The common roof of?
Yeah, such a name.
That's the intent.
Right, that's the intent.
The office of a naturopath.
That was the intent originally in the bill. It was just a matter of being more specific.
And we took the language from the veterinary statutes. That's the same language.
Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, adopted. Do people want to act on this now, or do you want me to put it off to the bottom of the calendar?
Mr. Chair, I have to leave at 2 o'clock, so I'd rather act.
Okay. Representative Donnelly, if you had enough time, I can't remember if you were here. I guess you weren't here when we had the previous hearing.
No, I haven't seen this one. Okay. I don't want to slow it down.
Okay, well, is there a motion then? Representative Zwacky, do you have kind of tried a chance to look at it?
Okay, keep going.
Great.
Keep going, fine.
Okay. Is there a motion to move the bill to individual recommendation?
So moved.
Okay, is there objection? Hearing none. Adopted.
Thank you.
You're
all
right. Okay. Just like, unlike some people that come by your meeting,
if someone could trot across and get Representative Moyer, we'll take up next. Review of travel advisors. He's promised me that this one will be quick. It's not quick, though.
Just make the motion before he gets there. That way he doesn't have to travel.
Okay. There you go. Okay, we got 1 minute. I'll fill in that. Oh, we have Representative Biden.
Yeah, he has a minute.
I'll come correct you and read it with the demo. Representative Moyer, the floor is yours. We've got an attendance, Representative Ivan, Representative Zlacky, Representative Brucklin, Representative Finkelstein, and on teleconference, Representative Parnell.
Oh, we are on teleconference. Thank you, Mr.
Mayor. But only Representative Parnell.
Okay, only Representative Parnell then. Appreciate the opportunity hearing this on a timely basis. I think the sooner we get a message into the State Department, the better, although this incident is behind us. It was quite the incident at the time. The bad news was they filed an erroneous travel advisory about the Yukon. The good news was they filed an erroneous travel advisory about the Yukon because it got us a lot of publicity and really didn't do us that much harm because of the rapid nature we were able to correct them. But I think it still would serve a very good purpose to sort of put them on notice in the future about these kinds of advisories. They really ought to consult with those who know the area, whether it's the Yukon or Alaska, and make for a more accurate travel advisory, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my remarks brief, since this, I think, is a pretty straightforward issue. Plus, he's busy.
No, Representative Moyer, I was hearing you completely. Is there questions from the committee? Representative Brucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moyer, was that an emergency? Did they feel it was an emergency that they had to get out?
No, certainly not an emergency. They routinely do these. I don't think anyone knows why that one came up. It probably was related to the outbreak of the disease, which I forget, in the eastern provinces. And in these advisories, they have three levels of severity. And this one was the lowest level. It wasn't considered any kind of emergency, just a notice, as they call it.
I still support this resolution, even if it is after the fact somewhat or as time goes on. Although I would certainly wish that if it were an emergency situation to them, that certainly then they could go forward with their advisory before contacting the affected parties. But
I'm sure they will in the case of emergencies. We can't bind them to anything. It's just a request and put it on record, too.
Representative Biden.
Thank you, Mr. These are the type that were, this is an example of what was issued.
Let's see if I see what you're looking at. I believe that was the actual text. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for Representative Moyer? What's the wish of the committee? This HJR 81. Representative Rucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that this committee pass this out with a provisional recommendation.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, so adopted. Thank you, Representative Moyer.
Thank you for your speedy consideration.
Representative Moyer, the floor is yours.
So fine, it was scheduled.
Not too light, but you're you never bring anything up that quick here before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate your early hearing of this bill. As you can see, it was introduced by the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. That actually kind of has a little bit of tradition to it. A couple of years ago, I served as the vice chairman of that committee and had a bill before you introduced at that time as a committee bill. And as several of you may remember, the bill did pass the Senate that year, only to die at the end of that session for failing to pass in the Senate. The issue is fairly straightforward. It would allow for optometrists to use, to, in this case as the bill is before you, to use pharmaceutical agents in their practice through either topical application to the eye or its appendages or administered orally. That's kind of the guts of the bill. What we've tried to do is build the case for broader access to health care to Alaskans that live in communities where there is either limited or no access to ophthalmologists, and in fact, what people in those communities have to do is rely on their optometrist for the primary eye care. And as such, the optometrists who are now limited in their practice should be allowed to expand their practice and use these topical and orally administered pharmaceutical agents. 30 other states have adopted language very similar to the bill as it is before you. We think it is the trend, and it is not out of the norm to allow for optometrists to more broadly practice their profession as they've been schooled and trained to do. And the issue generally has come down to kind of a competition and turf related issue. Ophthalmologists feel that this is encroaching upon their practice, and optometrists are clearly trying to practice their trade and provide primary health care to Americans, in this case, Alaskans. I hope that the committee, because there are people here, can answer very specific questions, that the committee agrees with the past House action and moves this bill on to the floor. I think that there probably is an accommodation to be made. I think you do have in your packet the letter from the Alaska State Medical Association, which suggests that there may be some accommodation. It's far from an endorsement letter of a bill, but it does suggest that with some changes, the improvement would be in the best benefit, or I think the phraseology is best interest of health care for all Alaskans. And if the committee chose to seek or take that action, I suppose that's available to you. But that I think there is some accommodation, so that the ultimate goal here of providing broader access to health care, eye health care, to Alaskans could be met. I'd be happy to answer questions. And as I said, there are folks here who are very familiar with the issue, been with it a long time, and can answer additional questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Boyer? If you could stay with us, or you have time to stay with us, I appreciate that, because I think there will be questions later we could use your thoughts on. Go next to Jeff Gonison from the Optometrists Association. Yeah.
My name is Jeff Gonison. I'm an optometrist and president of the Alaska Optometric Association and past president of the Alaska State Board of Examiners in Optometry. I'm an Alaska native, born and raised in southeast Alaska, and I've practiced optometry in Anchorage for over 15 years. My written and detailed testimony is in front of you in your packet. What I'll do is just sort of summarize with some oral comments and then answer questions in a few brief. Optometrists in Alaska practice under a limited and restricted license, so that any time we have an advancement in education or a new technology, we must come back to the legislature to update our scope of practice statutes. Our other medical and non-medical colleagues do not have to do this. They simply adopt new procedures or write new board regulations. In 1988, Alaska was the 49th out of 50 states to allow optometrists to receive an endorsement to their license to use diagnostic drugs on the eyes after meeting strict board requirements. This bill would amend the law allowing the use of therapeutic medication by board-qualified optometrists to treat common eye disorders that do not require the services of a surgical specialist. Alaskans in communities like Sitka, Kodiak, Homer, Ketchikan do not have access to eye care. Most Alaska communities have no medical specialists. However, the local optometrist is the most highly trained, specialized, and instrument-equipped provider of primary medical eye care available. There are over 60 doctors of optometry scattered throughout Alaska. The optometrist is often the first contact for a patient suffering from an eye disorder. Needed treatment can be started immediately, which is an important aspect in treating many eye diseases. Early diagnosis and treatment allows the optometrist to eliminate patient suffering and can prevent serious complications. Under current state law, the optometrists in most Alaska communities must refer their patients needing eye medication to a nurse practitioner, a health aide, or a general medical doctor with far less training in eye treatment than the optometrist has. Optometrists have been prescribing therapeutic medication in other states for over 16 years now, and 30 other states currently allow therapeutic treatment. Here's the map that's in your packet, and all the black states are states that allow optometrists to do therapeutic treatment, and there's 30 states now. Most from the west over, all but four states, and the rest are back east. No laws have ever been repealed, and 13 more states have therapeutic bills pending now, just like we do. Problems have virtually been non-existent nationally over the 16-year track record, and all the predictions of public harm have proven false. The malpractice insurance premiums for optometry are the same in states with with therapeutic drug laws and without therapeutic drug laws. My rate was $250 last year. The courts hold optometrists to the same standard of care as medical doctors. And just to summarize, optometry education and training is on a par with medicine, dentistry, and podiatry. An undergraduate college degree, then a four-year doctorate program, and often a residency in a hospital-based setting. Of all the health professions with similar educations, optometrists are the only ones not allowed to prescribe medications in Alaska. The letter in your packet from Les Walls, MD, he's a medical school professor and now an optometry school dean, that best explains our education. It's about a five-page letter right near the back here, almost there. Anyway, older optometrists who did not originally receive advanced therapeutic training would not be grandfathered. They would be required to return to school for additional training and pass the same rigid state board standards and examinations to be endorsed to use therapeutics. Two more points. Several agencies of the federal government have studied optometry and found competency in therapeutic treatment and surgical co-management. Because of this, optometrists are classified as physicians under federal Medicare law with respect to all services authorized by state law. Medicare patients are thus denied access to therapeutic eye care from optometrists in Alaska. The military and public health optometrists have used medications for many years. And last year, the American Public Health Association, which nationally represents over 52,000 health professionals, passed a resolution entitled Access to Treatment for Eye Care. This resolution recommends that legislators in all 50 states update their practice acts. The only reason for this legislation is to provide much better access to quality, affordable, and cost-effective eye care for Alaska, especially true in our smaller towns and communities. Time and expense would be saved by the public, the state health payers, by reducing unnecessary travel, lost work time, and not having to pay more than one doctor, and not having to pay the higher fees of a surgical specialist for a common primary care condition. According to the Journal of the American Medical Association, April 85, quote, the cost of primary care increases when it is provided by specialists without necessarily improving its quality, unquote. These cost savings have been well documented. Increased competition and freedom of choice among providers is a cost containment reality. I'll stop there and answer any questions.
Any questions from any committee members? Thank you for the testimony. I appreciate it. We'll go next on the telecom system to Peter Canera. Are you there, Peter?
Yes.
If you could just state your name for the record and offer your testimony, please.
Yeah, my name is Peter Canera, and I'm an ophthalmologist practicing in Salton, Alaska. And while I'm speaking for myself, I can pretty much say that I speak for probably 99% of the ophthalmologists in the state, and an overwhelming majority of the general physicians and surgeons in the state. And we ophthalmologists remain categorically opposed to opening the world of human medicine and surgery to non-medical practitioners. For the past 8 years or so, these non-medical practitioners have been at your doorstep requesting ever-increasing privileges so that they can further cross over from the time-honored profession of optics and refraction into the realm of medicine and surgery. We feel that such a change of professional practice should rightly come from attending the appropriate schools of medicine and surgery. bare facts will illustrate for you that despite the fact that ODs are far less trained than physicians and surgeons, they seek equal remuneration under Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement. They will not sell their services for any less than the most highly trained eye surgeon in the country. A simple visit to an ophthalmologist and an optometrist in Anchorage will clarify that for you very vividly. In conclusion, I'd like you to realize that if you pass this legislation, you are simply encouraging the ODs to return to you in the future for additional expanded privileges. They say they have to come to you every time they want to expand their practice, and nobody else does. And that is because nobody else wants to cross over into a different profession without seeking the proper training. If you feel this is a turf battle or it's presented as a turf battle, then I would submit to you that if an architect board says that you have to be a graduate of an approved school, if you feel as though that legislation would be a turf battle, then be that as it may. If you feel the engineering board would be a turf battle because they require the proper education, then again, be that as it may. If you feel a lawyer is engaged in a turf battle because they say you have to graduate from the correct school, then be that as it may. We're saying that if you want to cross over into a different profession, then you should pay your dues and get the proper schooling. And I think that's all. I'd like to open it up for questions now.
Thank you very much, Peter. Any questions from committee members? I've got one. In looking at the bill, it seems to do three things. It allows the topical application of drugs, allows the oral administration of drugs in four categories, and it allows removal of foreign bodies. Of those, what's, you know, your greatest objection and your least objection of those three activities?
Systemic, that is the use of medications by mouth, has nothing at all to do with treating acute ocular emergencies. There are only maybe one or two situations where a oral medication would need to be utilized, and that is available to anybody out in the field now as long as they have a telephone consultation from a physician. And so there's absolutely no reason for an optometrist to want to use oral medication unless he wants to get into treating diseases which have nothing at all to do with the problem at hand. And so that is probably the most onerous aspect of the whole piece of legislation. If we don't clarify the types of drugs that they would like to use, if indeed you all feel as though a compromise would be in order, then not clarifying specifically what topical medications they can use on the eye, it opens up a whole Pandora's box of them getting into treating chronic eye diseases, including diabetes, including glaucoma, which is well beyond the scope of optometry. If a compromise is indeed in order, then and somebody would indeed want to say that the only reason for their being down before you is to treat the acute emergencies in the bush, preventing them the need for having to come into town to get treated, then they should be perfectly content with limiting the medications to antibiotics as applied to the eye. Anything other than that would reveal the true intent of this legislation, and that is to get optometry into more serious forms of human medicine.
Thank you, Peter. The one of the problems we get into in all this is that the four of us here today on this committee aren't anywhere near the expert level that you and others are involved in this. So in trying to figure out categories in either in the topical or oral administration, it's very hard for us. Is there any way in just a couple minutes you could address in the area of topically administered drugs, the differences here? We do have in front of us a letter from the State Medical Association that suggests that topical administration be limited, but
it goes on to mention antibiotics, anesthetics, cycloplegics, and mydriatics, which I haven't a clue as to what they are. So
the cycloplegics and the mydriatics simply used to enhance the diagnostic capability of the optometrist. And that was granted to them by the legislature several years ago. And we don't really have any interest in changing that. The topical anesthetic is basically the Novocaine, which normally you all are used to getting injected into your gums for tooth work. And that is necessary for doing certain types of diagnostic tests and removing superficial foreign bodies from the eye. They are already able to use the topical anesthetic. And you all again granted them that privilege several years ago. The topical antibiotic simply means anti-infectives, and that of course means used to the eye. And this is the one which we feel, if a compromise has to be made, it can be included in their privileges without jeopardizing the health of the people. If you don't stipulate topical antibiotics, they're going to be out there treating viral diseases, and they're going to be out there using steroids for diseases which they may not be wanting to use steroids for. And it's basically for those two reasons that we feel as though, in order to satisfy the needs in the bush, one may want to insert simply the antibiotic as applied to the eye.
What's an example of a viral disease that they'd be trying to treat in the eye?
Most common one that we see is a herpes simplex virus. The second probably most common one is the herpes zoster or the shingles virus. And we feel as though these viruses have significant ramifications enough for the long-term health of the eye that they really should be managed by a physician. The conjunctivitis, that is the red eyes for which they can use the antibiotics, they may not get into too much trouble with unless they misdiagnose it. But anyway, we're willing to grant that, but we'd like to restrict them to the antibiotics to keep them out of the field of herpes and using steroids on the eye.
Thank you. Representative Ruffin.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think you might have cleared that up. I was wanting more information on red eye and the viral applications.
Good, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone on the teleconference or present who'd like to testify? If you'd like to testify? A note for the record, Ann Boudreau is here and is offered to answer any questions we'd have. Representative Boyer?
Yeah, could we have some response from Dr. Donaldson on?
I'd like to do that, but I just want to make sure we've completed the public testimony. Is there any further public testimony anyone wants to offer? The public hearing is closed. Representative Boyer, you had a question you want to ask?
Yes, of Dr. Donaldson, with regard to the difference between the antibiotics for diseases and then the other issue. I mean, what's differentiation? I'd like to understand.
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful.
Basically, in treating the eye, I would say 80% of the time we need topical drugs, ointments and drops. Okay. To touch briefly on the orals, the reason the orals are in those categories, mainly anti-infective. That, for example, there are certain diseases of the eyelid that drops aren't effective on. You need oral tetracycline, oral penicillin, or retinoids. The other oral drug analgesics for pain. If you get your eye scratched, it's very painful. Usually heals up in a day or two, but the pain is severe and you need something stronger than aspirin or ibuprofen. Same as the dentist use. As far as in the categories of topical drugs, topical drugs come in two forms, the diagnostic type, which we already use, which are just used to examine the eye, and then therapeutic drugs, which actually kill germs, kill viruses. And they're all, I don't want to be sending off the cuff, but they're mostly all safer than aspirin, mostly. Aspirin's quite dangerous, and people buy it all the time at the drugstore. And I don't really want to respond to anything that the other good doctor said, other than I believe all the evidence in front of you, and we'll basically refute the things about our training. And I've spent hours and hours and hours studying viral infections of the eye and how to treat them and so forth, and pass examinations to do that. And the modern optometrists now are taught by ophthalmologists in the medical schools. I just
I guess the question that partly Representative Barter is getting at is beyond use of anesthetics, what else is out there? The previous testimony is that it's treatment of viral diseases of the eye. Is that what's out there? If we were to say only anesthetics here, is that what we'd be precluding? Or is there something else out there?
Okay. What they're offering in this little thing is really, we have basically everything on your
eye.
So if you want to know the other categories of topical, there's anti-infective, basically. Now, anti-infective means it beats any infection. Okay, antibiotic will just work on a bacteria only. You need an antiviral drug to work on viruses, for example. Most of the drugs that the ophthalmologists and the optometrists and the physicians and nurse practitioners use most of the time for primary care are antibiotics and anti-inflammatories. Okay. Then much lesser used are the antivirals, antifungals. I don't think anyone's ever seen a fungal infection of the eye in Alaska. Too cold, you got to go to Alabama for one of those. And then anti-glaucoma agents and drops that reduce the pressure in the eye for treating glaucoma. And those are the main categories that we would use.
Any other questions from committee members? Thank you for joining us. I had a question for Ann Pedro, if you could join us. I'm not sure if I does the do you, does your division have an opinion on legislation? I suppose.
Yes, sir. I looked and thought that I would have brought one with me. We were not asked for position paper for this bill, but there is a companion bill on the Senate side that we presented last session. And quoting from memory, and I would be glad to furnish the committee with a separate position paper for this bill upon your request for that. We did not oppose this legislation. In looking through our files, the Optometry Board has had really an exemplary record as far as not having patient complaints for either excessive treatment or maltreatment and so forth. The nature of the complaints that we've had within recent files have actually been for things not directly related to the practice of optometry, but were ethics type of violations. Of a more personal nature, of a misconduct type of a thing. That was just one case, one incident of that. The concerns we had was that we were looking for a little bit better definition. We noticed that there was language there that stated that this was not intended to be invasive surgery, and that you could define that, but it would be using measurements of how deep in the eye and whether one layer of tissue was passed or not or something. What they were talking about was the superficial item that would be in the eye. But that was a concern that we wanted to make sure that it was limited to just that. And the other was that we had requested a definition of it. But it said the eye and its appendages, just what did that include? Did that mean the eyelid, the eyelashes, or a nerve or something connected to the back? And that was defined for us. And so basically, we have no objection to the bill. And
is there anyone, some really technical questions we're getting to here about, you know, the qualifications optometrists do some of these things. Is there anyone in the administration who would have enough experience in this area to talk, to have a strong opinion on whether optometrists should be administering oral drugs, for instance, and other questions we're talking about here? I know it's very technical, and
I wouldn't expect you to have the...
Right, and I thank you for that. Possibly the executive secretary for the nursing board, because by requirement she is a registered nurse. Now, whether or not we normally don't ask somebody from one discipline to comment on another one unless, you know, internally if we have some questions. I hate to characterize everything as a turf battle, although it appears to me from some of the testimony that that was heard both last year and this, that is a portion of it. And hopefully somebody that was representing the administration, even though they happen to serve a particular board that might have a conflict, say, from an advanced nurse practitioner, would be able to separate that, and we could certainly do that. We also, of course, administer the medical board, which does include the ophthalmologist, and could probably talk to those people a bit more at length. But we were basically going on what had been done in other states, did have correspondence from that, checked our own records as far as the types of complaints that we've had on optometrists in the past and so forth, and basically were could find no reason to oppose the bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Boyer has a question.
Not a question as much as a comment or a response to your question about medical doctors or other professionals who might get some guidance, and I think your backup information is full of testimony from doctors, medical doctors, MD types, who support the expansion that we're asking for in the bill. And one example comes from a Thomas Conley doctor in Ketchikan recently. It's a February 18th letter talking about some specific changes, one of which is to add for prescription of these drugs as well as then the deletion of the oral administration of the drugs. But his last paragraph, Dr. Thomas Conley, if I may just read for the record, says to
summarize.
He says, to put the whole thing in perspective, it should be pointed out that physician's assistants, who have much less formal training than optometrists, are routinely prescribing much more potent and dangerous drugs, including topical ophthalmologic drugs, than are proposed here. He goes on to argue that physician's assistants is a good thing to have, it expands the access to care. And then he goes on to say, Alaskans, it has indeed worked fairly well. That practice has, in a similar manner, it can be expected that well-trained optometrists will, granted the authority asked for here, extend competent eye care to many Alaskans who would otherwise not receive it. Letter from Dr. Lauren Halter, your file, Dr. Kevin Creelman, MD, supports your
turn. Where's the person from Ketchikan? Is that the person who used to be head of the Medical Association?
Yes.
The same
board.
Medical board.
Okay. Mr. Kenneth, I really have a comment that I have to make an answer to Representative Boyer, please.
I'm sorry, the public hearing is over. You can't just interject into a hearing.
Oh, I'm sorry, because the information you gave is not quite true.
Representative Boyer is just reading from letters in the public record. Anyone is welcome to submit letters to the public record. They just represent opinions. None of them are represented to be fact. Representative Ruffin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask Representative Boyer a question. I think I read most of those. It indicated that when an ophthalmologist recognizes there's a problem that he or she can't handle, then they confer with an ophthalmologist.
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay. I wanted to verify that was correct and that those protections are in place.
Any other questions for the administration? Thank you, Ann, for joining us today. President Ruffin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this legislation. I see that it's difficult to understand in many ways, and other than a consumer who's had a lot of these kinds of work done on herself and her family. I support the legislation. I'm curious how the chair.
Well, I have a couple amendments I'd like the committee to consider. See what you think. The first one is in line for the bill. Before the word use, put the words prescribe and use. It's basically just a technical amendment. That's certainly how I read it, is if you can use a drug or an agent, you can prescribe an agent. Before the word use, where it says licensee may use, to insert the words prescribe and use. I'm not sure that the administration would note any difference, in that would probably interpret a use being prescribed anyway. So, the any questions on that amendment and understanding? Everyone understand that amendment?
I do apologize. I know you had line four. What was the other one, please?
Well, I'm just going to do it one amendment at a time. The first amendment is to stick the words prescribe and before the word use. And?
Yes, sir. Just very quickly. I don't have a feeling one way or the other, except to mention that, you know, if it's your intent that since they're going to be doing it, that they wouldn't have to go to the expense for the patient of going to somebody else to prescribe it. But the pharmacy board would very much appreciate having that word prescribe in there, because it's very strict for them. They cannot compound or dispense for somebody that doesn't have particular prescriptive authority, and we've had that question come up before. So it would actually be making it easier for the pharmacist to be able to dispense to that patient. If, you know, if that's your intent, I think it would be a good amendment.
Thank you, Ann. Is there further discussion on that amendment?
Maybe
Sean said, can someone offer that officially?
I would be happy to offer that, Mr. Chairman, as you read it.
Is there objection to the amendment offered? Hearing none, so adopted. Second amendment I want to consider is removing all of 1B. It's just an attempt to reach a compromise here with some of the concerns expressed. It'd be removing the ability to administer oral drugs. Any thoughts on that? Anyone want to offer that as an amendment?
I would.
You don't want to offer it?
Mr. Chairman? I would so move the amendment.
Okay, Representative Zaki has offered it as an amendment. Is there discussion on that amendment?
Would you explain your amendment?
Sure, it's just a question of what's the, this. Although I don't think this is properly characterized as a turf battle, because that implies that, you know, that's the motivation behind it. But in essence, it comes down to trying to find a balance on, you know, what various practitioners should be allowed to cover. You know, we've got evidence on both sides. Seems to me when it comes to oral drugs, we're just taking another step further. And we could go and, I think, investigate those. We could go into the analgesics, the decongestants, the antihistamines, the anti-glaucoma, the anti-infective, and we could try to find somewhere out there among those which of those are the ought to be the proper province, you know, of the administering. But I hate to even get into that. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure I can conquer it in the area of topical, which sounds simpler. And so my problem is I'm not sure how we can...
Mr. Chairman, by
differentiate
deleting,
among those.
By deleting those, then you wouldn't be limiting. In other words, the licensee could prescribe and use the
topicals.
Only topicals. That wouldn't be limited.
Right. Representative Brecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a problem because, as we heard in testimony, there are times where a drug is necessary to comply with the physician's opinion on taking care of the problem. If you need antibiotics, a topical application of an antibiotic needs to have an oral application along beside it to be effective. A topical application is used up very quickly. And I think it's very limited. Are you limiting this person who's a professional in their ability to do the job? At least I read this as limiting.
It is, but we certainly, it's just a balance. We certainly wouldn't be authorizing them to do open heart surgery. And so, you know, where that balance is and what the proper level of drug is. I already admitted I can't pretend to have any sense of where that line is myself. All I can do is take the evidence before us and try to balance it out. And I come to the conclusion that we get into a new area when we get into the oral administration of drugs. Now, I'm not sure that area is wrong. And I, you know, if we wanted to
to go on further with this, I think we could get testimony on those various categories, try to justify. I bet we could find that we could justify some of those categories. At this point, I just don't think it helps this legislation or our committee process to pursue that avenue and find those things, because we're gonna have to get in here some of the people I was asking Ann about, some administration testimony and a lot more testimony on the categories of orally administered drugs. And
Mr. Chairman, I would, if you're negotiable, I could see the anti-glaucoma, perhaps, but it's limited already to the anti-infective, analgesic, decongestant, and histamine. I find those minor applications of orally administered drugs.
Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps it makes sense because there are some additional questions. I mean, every committee does it a little bit differently, but perhaps it makes sense to have a work draft bill that makes the changes, the one that's already been adopted and the second one that's been described as deletion of B, and then have your committee members think it through for a couple of days or whatever you think is necessary. And for those people who want to look at the other issues here with the orally administered proposals, they could get some additional information. I'll try to get some additional information and bring it back to the committee as well. But I think that the questions are large enough or substantial enough that we could spend a few more days taking a look at it. This is the last committee referral before it goes to the floor. And my experience in dealing with this bill once on the floor is it gets fairly wide-ranging, and we don't have, I think the first time we had it, we didn't have a doc then either, but we didn't have quite the access to the medical people that we needed on the floor. So if we can answer some of the questions prior to the floor, that probably makes sense.
Just deciding whether to deal with the Second Amendment, what's, as a sponsor of the activists following this legislation, what's your feeling on my Second Amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think from the testimony that's been put forward by the Medical Association and by the doctor who spoke today and in speaking with the optometrist, that is not an unreasonable accommodation to move the bill forward. To eliminate B. But I think you can keep the issue open for a few days if you need to do that.
Okay, Representative Wacky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I appreciate Representative Boyer's comments there. I think maybe it would help us and maybe some others if we could kind of put it together in a CS form and get some additional input over there between this meeting and the next. And I just wanted to make a comment. I know we talk about, quote, unquote, turf battles out there, but I have the highest respect for the medical community on all sides, including those in this room and those who have been testifying and the medical association's comments out there. But I think we also have to realize that when you do try to expand into new avenues for a certain segment of that profession, we do need to be very careful as to what we're going to prove or disapprove out there. So I understand and I respect all the testimony here, but I think maybe that one more day or looking at a committee substitute with those appropriate amendments and then getting some more input would help us all. At least it would help me.
Well, Representative Wacky, I think you make a good point. I feel ready to act today, but I think there's no harm in holding it over. Let's act on this amendment, though, I suppose.
First one?
No, we already adopted the first one on the Second Amendment. Is there objection to the Second Amendment? I hear no objection. It's adopted. We'll incorporate this into a new CS. We'll have this before us at the first thing on our next meeting, which is Tuesday. Is that a time you can make? Okay, it'll be the first item.
On the other hand, if it's just a simple and kind of change,
well, I think, Representative, I'm willing to go forward now. I'm not sure we're going to get any more enlightened, but we do have a policy that when committee members want to hold something over, Representative Swacky would like an additional day to look at. So I do think we will act on it promptly at that point. That's satisfactory.
That's fine.
Okay, we now have our final bill.
For the record, I support the holding over bill. I need to contact my constituent.
Okay, good.
And reference this, so it will work out for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You could just stay here somewhere, so it looks like we have a forum. We do have Representative Parnell. Are you on the line?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Okay, and Dan's here as well. Would you like Dan to speak on your behalf because he's here?
I would appreciate that, and can you let me know what committee members are present?
Well, sad to say, it's Representatives Zawacki and I. But I'm just sure Representative Ivan is going to come back in and...
He's here.
Oh, Representative Ivan is here. Oh.
There's three
of us here. With you fourth in line, our understanding of the rules are we can act on any amendments using a vote of a member on teleconference. We just can't pass a bill out with a vote on teleconference.
And that's why I was hoping Representative Donnelly could return after his bill.
There's not judiciary today. Well, I think what we'll do is get as far as we can without a quorum, and when we reach the point of final passage, we'll send out some people and drag in some member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Dan, if you could join us, and let me try to put us back to where we are so the committee members know. We assigned this bill to a subcommittee. The subcommittee came back with a CS. CS is in the packet, and there's some further amendments we wanted to discuss. I think you could take it from there.
For the record, this is Dan Garrett, aide to Representative Pat Parnell. We have right now a CS from the subcommittee, and we have made different changes according to the wishes of the subcommittee and other members of the Alaska Association of Realtors. They gave some suggestions, which we initially did not follow, but we decided to follow, as they would make the bill a lot easier to understand. First of all, the first change we did is we made a change in the title. We inserted residential before the real property in the title because we wanted to directly affect residential property, and we figured that would centralize it a little bit more. We also replaced sales at the very end with transfers. And the reason being is it was informed to us is that sometimes property does get transferred without without being sold, being bought. So therefore, what we did is we changed the word transfers, therefore to allow for all transfers of property, whether it was from a will or etc. This brings me to the next change is that from what we did is we changed seller to that of transferor and buyer to that of transferee. We did that throughout the bill. And the rationale, again, is it would be more broad, allow people who would transfer an interest in property to be included in this bill, whereas before, if it was buyer-seller, they would be excluded. Section 3470.010, disclosures required. We inserted the word that instead of the for transfers interest. The second line on that, we deleted that is used as a residence. That was repeating what was earlier said in the line. We deleted section C because it was felt that it would put the banks in there unfairly when in this section they would be used primarily for financing the loan. Therefore, why would they be held to a higher level? If a bank was selling property, it would fall under the act as that as a transferor, so therefore they would be covered under that. Going down to section 3470.030, liability for errors and omissions. We reworded the section to eliminate section number 3. Section 2, I'm sorry. And we replaced the level of care with due diligence instead of what is now as ordinary care. Figured that would put a higher level again on whoever was being transferred or transferee. On section 3470.040, which is subsequent events and approximations, there somehow a word got in there, and we ended up removing that word, which was not from the last line of A before requiring to. So then the person would be required to deliver an amendment of a disclosure statement to the transferee. On the form of disclosure statement, which is 3470.050, we had it built in to microwave. It was argued that some people might bring in a microwave, therefore would become part of the property. and we added line 11, then we renumbered accordingly, that the property is located in the floodplain, avalanche area, high wind area, permafrost area, or earthquake zone. And that was suggested to us quite a long time ago. The reason why we have so many different areas is if we bunched them all together, then it might be considered that they all had to be one for it to be happening. Escrow agents. We deleted 3470090, which would deal with escrow agents. Felt that they should be included as they fell outside the scope of this legislation. 3470100. Duties of brokers. On the first line, we inserted or one or more. It originally read one. And there were some cases which maybe one or more realtors would be there, which, such as the listing agent. We included that in section or number D. And then we went down to definitions. We added a definition for residential property. We changed the sales definition to that of transfers. And then we added a section 2, which would give the real estate commission the authority to determine if the real estate agent's license should be revoked or suspended for violating this act. And that's a brief rundown of what we did in the
discussion. Any questions for Dan? Thank you for joining us. Is there anyone else present who wants to testify today on this legislation? Conrad, did you want to offer any comments?
Just our written comments that I assume everyone's received.
Okay. Well, we just got yesterday, then March 10th. Okay, great. Let's plow through a series of amendments we've got, and then we'll be open to other amendments after that point. First one I've got, I assume they're everyone's packets, right?
Yeah, they're attached to it.
First one is amendment by Representative Parnell. Second one's representative amendment by me. Third one we'll go to is oh yeah, they do. They have to do that first, right? And the third one is going to be one from something we need for Terry Banister pointed out. We can have a motion to adopt a CS that moves along. Representative Swaffy,
we're not on a teleconference.
We are. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make a motion at this time to accept committee substance for House Bill 398-3292.
Okay, is there objection to adopt this? Yes. Hearing none, so adopted. The first amendment before us is by Representative Parnell. The idea here is just to address what the damages are for violation of this chapter. It makes a differentiation that if it's a willful, meaning a knowing violation, then you can get up to three times the actual damage. If it's not a willful violation, then all you can be awarded is your actual costs and the court costs. So it's trying to make a differentiation between willful violations, which will be very rare, and unintentional violations. Representative Parnell, you've got a copy of the amendment with you?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do, and it was basically taken from the language from the Consumer Protection Act.
Okay, is there any discussion on this amendment, amendment number one? Okay, is there any objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing no objection, is adopted. Amendment number two is offered by myself. The idea behind amendment number two is to just pin down that, you know, you get liability protection for anything that you disclose, but it's limited to items that you disclose. If you don't disclose it or you don't know about it, you don't get any liability protection. It's sort of an obvious point. I don't see it as being anything different than the intent of it all. States it very clearly that the transferor is not liable for defect in the real property being transferred if the transferor discloses the existence of the defect, basically the way it is written. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Parnell?
Thank you. I have a question from a person who has been sitting in the teleconference room here in Anchorage. And this person has a friend who really has a real limited knowledge about houses, period. And his point is that she's a person who doesn't know much about houses, doesn't have the money to have anybody check them out. And he wanted to know, could she possibly have a sentence in this particular amendment that would indicate that if they chose not to fill in the disclosure, that the person just buys it at face value and what they see is what they get?
Let's take that up as an additional amendment. It sounds to me like what the idea behind that amendment is to say, if you don't want to participate in this program, you don't have to, and I'm not sure what all the implications of that are. I had thought what we were trying to do was require these disclosure statements, so I'm not offering a strong opinion, but I think it would confuse this particular amendment. We'll have time for amendments at the end. Is there any questions or discussion on amendment number two? Is there objection to amendment number two? Okay, hearing no objection to amendment number two, stop it. For amendment number three, we don't have one. Terry, you could join us. We're passing out here amendment number three. It's apparently relatively technical in nature. It says on it, and just for Representative Parnell's benefit, it says page 9, line 4, following transfers of, insert interest in. Terry?
Yes. I'm Terry Bannister. This addition is necessary. This is the applicability section that basically says that only things that occur after the effective date of this bill are covered by this bill. And there's just a technical addition. The bill itself covers transfers of interest in real property. And this section right now says transfers of residential real property instead of transfers of interest in residential real property. And it's necessary to coordinate the two. And as a technical change, we would suggest that would be done.
Thank you, Terry. Any questions? Any objections to amendment number three? Hearing none, it's adopted. Amendment number four is by me. It was a recommendation from Ambudreau. What it says, actually Representative Parnell has a copy in front of him, so I won't read it. But the idea is that we've got a disclosure list in the bill, and that this is basically the kind of things we consider to be concerns about housing in 1992, and by the year 1994, 1995, we may discover there's something like asbestos or something else we weren't aware of, and we ought to give the department the ability to add to this list. I think it's a relatively minor concept. If we don't do this, every few years we have to come back and argue about what should be disclosed. And since these aren't requirements of law that you have to do anything about these conditions, since they're just disclosure, I feel like it's an area we ought to leave to the administration. Is there Representative Zwack?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. No disrespect for the maker of the motion or the administration, but I have always believed that anything that is going to get changed in statute is our responsibility and not the administration's, to simply change a regulation. And I will oppose this amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, there's objection to the amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment before we take a vote? Representative Parnell, what's your thoughts on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I can appreciate the department's interest in it, but it would seem like a legislative prerogative at this point.
Okay, further discussion? Okay, all in favor of the amendment indicate by saying aye. Aye. All opposed to the amendment indicate by saying no.
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 Okay, record shows Representative Finkelstein, aye, Representative Ivan, Sawacki, and Parnell, no. I think I need two more committee members. Amendment number five is Amendment number five is offered by Representative Parnell. It deals with any questions about, trying to clear up any questions about condo units, zero lot lines, other commonly held properties. Just clarifies that these properties are covered. Is there any
concerns or questions on amendment number 5?
Just 1 second, Chair.
No, go ahead. I understand. I'm sorry.
Okay, is there concerns or is there objection to amendment number 5? Okay, hearing no objection, amendment number 5 is adopted. Do we have any additional amendments to come before the committee? The one item we had mentioned by Representative Parnell is the ability to opt out. You know, I just offer my personal opinion that we ought to be requiring this. People are free to, you know, put down honest answers. They can say, I don't know. They can, you know, there's no requirement that they go out and hire a hire someone to survey their house and give them definitive answers. It's just a disclosure of what they really do know, and I don't feel it's that owner's requirement. Representative Zlacky?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to maybe mention, repeat almost what you said there. I think if there is a concern that Representative Parnell has brought up with someone in Anchorage, this bill is going to go through judiciary, and I'm sure it's going to have probably the same amount of discussions and be worked out as this committee has done, and that's something that could be addressed in judiciary.
I think that's a good point Representative Zlacky's made. Well, if they don't have any additional amendments, we're going to sit and pause for about 5 minutes until 20 till, which by which time we hope to scour up a fourth member who's actually present in Juneau. And if we can, then we will do something else.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll stand by.
Ed, I don't think there's much help you can be in this, Representative Parnell, but I don't care. So,
well, just a question, I guess, if we're at an ease or something like that. Can we legally fax the sheet down to Representative Parnell for him to sign and fax it back?
Well,
electronics, is it legal for electronic?
I don't know what the basis for it is, but we asked Legal Affairs, and their answer was that committee members on teleconference can vote on amendments. They can't vote on passing the bill up. It's probably something that, you know, I think you can have very informal decision-making when it comes to amendments and things, but I think you've got to have the four people sitting here to actually pass something up.
Who can we get now? I'll volunteer to get.
Oh, good. Well, can't get him. You probably won't get him.
Carries out of town.
Yeah,
as long as you have a long rope, so we could pull you back.
I think we've sent out Catherine, so let's see who she can say. Gee, you know, we got some time. Is there any other bills we got behind on or something?
I think you've set a record here, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, 5 bills. But we didn't pass one on, so.
For now, a question about one of the items that.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, you're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Well, I'm afraid Ann Boudreau is going to ask some question that's going to confuse things, so go ahead, Ann.
You may be right. Representative Parnell, on page 8 of the bill, letter I, looks like new language that has been added, and all of the letters before that appear to be if an individual licensee does something that is a violation of the real estate chapter. This one references regulation in a way that does confuse me. This violates the licensee's obligation under AS 34.78.100, and the violation occurs under circumstances that the commission determines by regulation justify the suspension or the revocation of the license. By putting in determines by regulation, that would normally mean writing a regulation which would state all the ways that not putting this in might be considered a violation of the law. So that seems like a repetition. Is that what you meant, or was it that if they don't produce the disclosure statement for the transferee or fail to tell the transferor that he's supposed to sign one and make sure that it passes through, that in itself is a violation of the license law? And if so, I don't think the ones that determines by regulation. That's not how the commission makes decisions about whether or not to take action against the licensee. So can you tell me what the intent of that was?
I was thinking we were keying off your recommendation on that before, and we may not have got the language correct. Maybe Dan can come forward and work out a proper language there, if he's still in the room.
Well, we had talked briefly during the recess, and if this was off my suggestion that you're requiring the agent to do it, but since it cross references to another statute, you know, is it cause for discipline if they fail to do it? I would suggest that you would start with the same language and have violates the licensee's obligations under AS 34.70.100, eliminate and the violation occurs, pick up under circumstances that the commission determines, delete by regulation, since that's not the vehicle that we would determine it.
I understand.
And then pick up with justify, and rather than the suspension or revocation of the license, maybe substitute a broader term, disciplinary action against the license. And that is because there might be a circumstance where a warning letter or a letter of reprimand might be considered appropriate action, or perhaps a probation. There are a lot of different actions other than just suspension or revocation. And that was my original intent when we had discussed it. If that does not conflict with what you're wanting to do, it looks to me like the drafter may have made some alterations because he didn't understand what we were trying to get at before.
So it would sound like this. I violates the licensee's obligations under AS 347100 under circumstances that the commission determines justifies disciplinary action against the license.
Correct.
That would be fine, and if that would be amendment number 6, if the chairman would want to entertain that.
Well, I'd love to, but we're really low on members now. Let's write that one up. I think our best bet for getting a quorum on this is to just temporarily adjourn until 3 p.m. We will try to drag back in Representative Bruckman, Representative Ivan, and Representative Zwacky and I, who are already here. Representative Zwacky, can you do that walk in here for a minute at 3 p.m.?
Yeah.
Okay, we're all going to re-meet right here at 3 p.m. and try to complete this. If someone wants to write up in the meantime, this amendment is amendment number 6. We actually have written up.
Does need to be replaced somehow.
Okay, well, if we have that by 3 o'clock, we'll act on it. If we don't, we'll just leave that for Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
There are a number of things that are going to need to be taken up in Judiciary. I'm not sure we've dealt with all the concerns of this bill, but so the meeting's going to be held in temporary adjournment till 3 p.m. Representative Parnell, I don't feel like you need to stay around if... you need to go because there's a chance we won't get the forum.
Conference operator, no, we'll save a little airtime.
Okay, so we'll end the teleconference this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Representative Parnell.
I didn't know
that.
Wow!
Yeah!
I told you.
You got some kind of employees.
That's great. My employees never do that for me when I'm in my office.
You never let us.
Okay, we need to call back to order. We have before us House Bill something or other, House Bill 398. No one wants to offer that last amendment. Okay, is there a motion to adopt the bill with any good recommendations?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zwacky moved it. Representative Bruckman, Zwacky, and I have been picked on our president. Is there objection? Hearing objection, bill is adopted. Any good recommendations? Meeting adjourned.